look at that. You did that yourselves. Very nice. Very nice. I think some people have left, so if you're in the back and you'd like to come forward, we'd love that, because I think it's just a warmer community if you can kind of move forward. So those of you who are seated in the background, if you feel like it, just come on down, because there's some good seats. Good seats. So this is the part of the program where we get together and we just chat it up. We talk a little bit about our perspective on how we feel about the things that you've heard tonight. And then I've listened in on some of your conversations, and I've really heard some questions that have been posed, and I'd like to pose it to the whole group. So if you don't mind, I'm going to just throw something out there. And we have about 30 minutes with this segment. Those of us who like to chat a lot, we're going to try and keep it to short answers. But can you be as poignant and fabulous as you can be? In 30 minutes? Okay. So first question. If you are a person who is not a part of the communities or the cultures that we're speaking of today, what can you do in order to make a difference? And how do you even start? If you are a person who is not native, who is not a part of what we're talking about today, how do you as a how do you, as a example, a white person who has no native background but feels exactly what you're talking about as far as the treatment of native women, of native culture in our society, how do you go about becoming a change agent for good?
Well, I'm going to answer shortly, and then I'll let you guys get serious. Native Arts and Cultures Foundation, right? You guys could donate money to that.
Amen.
We'll start
Amen.
Off with that. What's the other sponsor of this?
RAC.
All right. So we'll just throw that out there. That's two. Now you guys can be serious. I am serious about donating to those. So.
Yeah. That's probably the elephant in the room, right? You need money to do some of the things that you need to do. Mm-hmm. Anybody else come up with something?
I think, especially, you know, where we are in Portland, Oregon, the whitest city in America, full of such delightfully woke white people who occupy so much space. I think there is a fear to engage at all. Because there's a fear of getting everything wrong. And I think historically, given the fact that they've only gotten everything wrong, that's valid. But at the same time, if you don't actually listen and ask and try to make some attempts at something, at some understanding, you're not going to go anywhere. My friend Larissa Fasthorse just did an amazing play at Artist Repertory Theater called The Thanksgiving Play, where it's like four white people trying to put on a Thanksgiving history play for children, and they want to represent natives, but they realize none of them are native, so instead they just don't make a play at all. And they're like, look at what we've achieved here, and it's nothing. They've done nothing by the end of the show. And I think that really speaks to this, the subtleties of well-meaning white supremacy, where instead they just continue to invisibilize and continue to not try to engage.
So to take the charge and just do something.
Yeah, but like try to learn from us.
Is it from a place of knowledge? You want them to learn something first, right? So that, because sometimes when people just jump in and do something, it takes us back like 40 years, you know?
Yeah, I think there's just a fear to ask or engage. I think there's definitely an interplay there where we also, I know with minorities, there's this idea of we shouldn't have to be doing all the education and the emotional labor. But at the same time, we're the ones who are versed in it. And sometimes we have to speak Otherwise, people won't learn.
I hear your wheels turning.
Well, I'm just thinking it's really complicated issues, and that they're not...
The issues are very complicated, and they're never taught in school. Our histories, the history of Native Americans is just this buried history, and partly because, you know, as I'm part white, obviously, we're implicated in the supremacy of that, so you don't really want to know the history of what went on, that we're all living on this stolen land, and it's just such a... It's just such an ugly fact that you can almost not go forward if you think, well, really, we shouldn't be here. I don't know. I just feel like so much of it is we need more education at the base level about how the country was founded, not just on the lands of Native Americans, but on the whole economies that our country is based on took advantage of people of all races, or, you know, blacks and Native Americans mostly. And throw in some Chinese out here in Oregon.
To be serious here, obviously I'm speaking to a group that already gets it. But for the most part, it's to try to get people to listen. And you're all here listening to us. So you obviously understand that and get that. But I think we're minimized outside of like panels like this, where our voices aren't heard, right? I don't know what the percentage is now. I know we're producing more kids, so we will have in the future, we will have more people and have more of a leverage. But you know, when somebody's speaking about the traditions of their land, if you listen to that and adopt some of that, I'm not saying to copy, but the behind everything is a process and understanding what that is, right? And just adopt that way. Try to think like we think so that you can at least be better stewards. Don't think about yourself. Think about the future, right? It's easy to have ethics and morals when we have money, but we all forget that as soon as the light bill comes due, right? Or the rent comes due. So just, I don't know, think Indian. That doesn't make you Indian, but just think Indian, okay?
I think that we should just be open with one another, because, like, you know, I cannot imagine what it would be like not to have the customs that I have, to have the culture that I have, to not make flutes every week, to not honor the women in my family the way that we do. I just couldn't imagine not having these things. So when I think about somebody who doesn't necessarily have the same culture as I do, it leads me to be more open because they may not know as I know, but also to put myself in their shoes, I don't know also in what they know. So just to be a lot more open. So the things I think people can do is probably just be a lot more open, be patient with yourself and also with everybody else. And not everybody's understanding, but try to be that understanding, you know.
I was speaking with the panel backstage, and I was talking about people in their toolboxes and what they have, you know, what they can access in order to communicate and to connect with others. And the responsibility of all of us, we know it, is that we are bound to be the ones that have to teach. Because when you receive the enlightenment of where you're going and what you're trying to do, the responsibility falls on you. Now, does it mean I can't teach other people how to at least understand, you know, where I'm coming from or where my people are coming from? I even have to teach my people who are Native American, but we're African American and Native American, which is a whole nother idea going on, right?
I have a take on it.
Yeah, please.
So one of the things I often talk about in my writing and my lectures is the issue that Native, we are not just another minority group. We're not another ethnic group. We're actually sovereign. We're citizens of sovereign nations. Only sovereign nations sign treaties. You know, the U.S. Signed treaties. When its first treaty was signed with the Native Nation. In fact, no other country in the world would recognize the United States, but this indigenous nation had already signed treaties with many different nations in the world. A treaty does, you cannot, under international law, and treaties are international law, you cannot sign away your existence. So often I think a lot of Americans think that when we sign treaties, we disappeared, right? That's not true. It was an act of sovereignty to sign a treaty. I think the thing that Americans of all backgrounds can do, and I was actually reminded that I gave the Sewell lecture this year at the First Unitarian Church, and I read from some of my writing, and after the dog attacks at Standing Rock, when dogs were used on water protectors who were putting themselves in front of equipment that was digging up. And these were actually Ihonktawan, Yankton, my people. These were their sites. These were their burial grounds. My great-great-grandfather was born just across the river from Cannonball where the camp was at Standing Rock. The Yanktons traveled all the way up there. And these were dug up by energy transfer partners because they had filed an injunction, the tribe had filed an injunction identifying the locations of these burial sites and these sacred sites, and they moved their equipment over there, like several miles, and dug it up the next day. They filed the injunction on Friday over Memorial Day weekend, and then on Saturday, or Labor Day weekend, and then on Saturday, they were there in the morning and they were digging them up to destroy the evidence so that it would not impede the building of the pipeline, right? And so people put themselves in the line, water protectors put themselves in line to stop this, and they were attacked by dogs, right? And I wrote a piece, an article that was in Telesur, and I was just, you know, I think that every American has to realize that they are a colonist. You are a colonist. No matter, I would say that Black people have a different position because, of course, the huge price they paid to be here, you know, and as part of the history of this country. What that means, you know, and that this is done on your behalf. The attack by dogs, the right to the land, you know, all of this is done on your behalf. And you really have to think, what would ethical colonialism look like? That's the question I always ask. What would it look like? If you are a colonist, right, and this is what colonists do, right, colonial systems do, you know, and you are a good person, you know, you feel yourself to be a good person, what would ethical colonialism look like? Can it exist? And how do you create it? Because what the system we have right now is destroying Indian people. We have the highest rates of suicide, bar none, in this country. We have the highest, I just wrote an article about missing more indigenous women that came out yesterday in High Country News. And you know, we have the high, I mean, in some counties, Native women have 10 times the rate of murder of anyone else in this country. Native men between the ages of 25 and 35 have the highest rates of murder by police, 6 times that of anyone else, you know? I mean, we are paying the price for the American dream. And these are statistically, you know, you can analyze this, you can have the numbers, and you can see the cost of the colonialism, of your dream. And so the question I ask of Americans is, how can you be an ethical colonist? How is this possible? How can we remake this relationship?
Yeah, and that doesn't sound like a victim speaking. You know, and sometimes people turn off from you if you still carry your pride after being beaten down. That you still can speak from a point of intelligence and of pride and of love for your fellow man and still try to reach out. That's what's happening. That's what's happening. And if you're waiting for us to shudder or for people to shudder and pull back, we can't. Because racism is on the rise. We know that. We know that. That's a truth. It's always been here, but it is on the rise now. And the murder and the annihilation of people. So we, you know, that's a great answer. What are you going to do if you're ethical? That changes the whole way you think of what can I do? You can do anything you can do to change the dynamic. Change the dynamic. Here's a question. What has been the response from the local non-Native community? Your film, those you speak to, what's been the response?
I know locally we showed our film at the Portland Film Festival, and I mean everyone had questions about the solution, and I looked to Isaac and I was like, there's not one solution. And that's just the truth. You know, there's many different solutions. You can connect with the family members who have somebody who's missing, and you can be a part of that. You can help print posters out, help pass them out. I mean, help get the word out there, help share posts, and try to be as part of the conversation as much as possible. And when we showed our film at the Portland Film Festival, we had a couple ladies walk up to us, and they had a handful of papers. And we knew, we anticipated this happening with the content that we filmed, and it was for Ashley Heavy Running. Her older sisters came to us, and she asked if we could we can help them out as much as we can with showing the film, and their response to it was that we were doing it right for them, and that I'm glad that we were able to just be a part of the conversation to help that. And so we're in contact with them now, and we want to help them out as much as we possibly can. And, you know, everyone else can also be a part by participating in marches and by participating in injunctions and film screenings and such, and I think that's super important. And I think the response has been very well. A lot of people don't know what's going on at all. You know, especially when we showed our film in Paris, nobody had any idea. We were the only two Native Americans there out of 300 other filmmakers. And when we showed our film, we had a very positive response. And it gets them to thinking about solutions and how they can be a part of it. And those are people from, you know, around the world. So I thought that was really amazing as well. And I hope we represented well, you know.
Yeah, I think that the non-Native crowd really had, some of them had no idea at all, and some of them were just seeing this stuff on the news or, you know, heard about it through a friend who's Native American. And we were in Parker, Arizona, and we thought that people were taking these notes. You know, this is one of our first Q&As that we had done. And we'd done like student Q&As before, and nobody was holding anything really to take notes. They were missing posters, you know, babies and aunties and sisters and all that. And that was something that was like, wow, just kind of like just flooring at the moment. Like, you know, these folks are missing. And when we were looking at these posters, it was very, very tough for us. In the Portland Film Festival, we snapped pictures of the poster. We put it online like right away, you know, any way we could help. And I think that being a part, like a very small piece of the movement, it's tough as a Native American males to be representing this particular issue with our film. You know, and film lives are very, very short for short films. You know, we have like a year where it's going to be something that someone's going to listen to. And then that's it. It's done. For instance, you look at Wind River. Wind River was out, and they got 9 months of buzz, and then that was it. It's all done. It's in the dirt. You know, like right now we have the Avengers in theaters, and then it'll be, you know, 4 months from now it'll be a meme, and then that's it. It'll all be done. And so what we've been able to do is share it with universities and community venues like this one here, and being able just to get the word out about it. And also as somebody who grew up in a very, very female dominant house, when you think about walking down the street, you know, some guys think, oh, I'm just gonna walk down the street. If you're a female and you're thinking about walking across the street, you're thinking about keys in your hand, you're thinking about, you know, where your pumps are at, like, you know, if you're gonna like nail somebody with those, you know, you're thinking about where your mace is, am I safe running, do I have enough on me. And it's stuff that I don't think that folks think about. And so I think through the film, for the non-Native crowd to come out and say, you know, if there is some way I could help because I didn't know, I think that's wonderful. And there's some folks that, you know, absolutely like the film, and some of them are just kind of on the fence. And either way, I'm really glad that we've provoked people just to get involved. And through this process of us going out and speaking and whatnot, we got a ring on the phone about a friend of ours we'd worked with who was missing for some time, and she was found deceased. And it really even drove it even more home for us. And this is something that, you know, we didn't plan on. We did this on a weekend, and for all of us sitting around thinking, like, you know, what really ties us together in domestic violence, missing Marine Indigenous women, and about survivors we have in our family, you know, and talking about that. All of us on the cast and crew got closer, and I remember having that moment and being like, you know, is this a story that we want to tell? Is anybody going to get it? And being in Corvallis about 2 weeks ago, being asked the question, like, what is the one thing, what was your one fear about doing this particular film? And my only answer for it was acceptance. Is it going to be accepted enough to be shown, or is it just going to be kind of shut away as that whiny Indian story film? And I guess that's my response.
What are your greatest challenges as working as Native artists today? We have artists in film, we have artists, you know, that are doing all kinds of beautiful work. And what is your challenge as a Native artist today?
I think it's to portray our work with authenticity, or as much as authenticity as we can. There's many different tribes out there to be represented, and everyone has a different story, and they have their own story. And I feel like us as artists want to portray just as much realness as we possibly can through our work.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel a challenge with presenting your work at all?
I think for me, it's more about the biggest challenge really is supporting yourself and having the time to get everything done when everything is already stacked against you. I think I work like 8 different jobs. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a play. I do 2 podcasts. I do a lot of work, and I'm still like at the poverty line. That's a fun feeling. I think I've had some amazing success this last year. My fellowship from the Native Arts and Cultures Foundation really changed the whole course of my career. But there's also literally hundreds of thousands of Native artists out there that aren't getting those. And that institutional support and that ability to get your work out to a wide audience is really crucial. And it's hard to cultivate when you're already trying to just get by.
I think what I struggle with is the lack of a market, not so much for me, but for other Indigenous people to make a living, right? Mm-hmm. And definitely lack of a market that's rooted in the cultural
specificity.
Right, what she said. Kachia, I think, is the word for it. But the aesthetic sensibility that's from this area alone, people aren't aware of that. They are not aware of that. We have, and I'm not saying that other Indigenous art is wrong, but there's a market that's been going on for several, over 150 years coming out of Alaska. So when people come to buy artwork, Native artwork, you go into the Oregon Historical Society, you go into the PAM, you go into any place, what are they buying? They're buying Indigenous artwork that's specific to Canada and Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So we don't have a market here. I'm at the base level just trying to teach basic carving lessons and basic aesthetic rules that come with our own traditional art forms to my own people, or even to other people that are in tribes that are local here in Oregon, so that we can at least build a market. But we've got to pressure these institutions. And is anybody here from the PAM? Because I'm going to lay into you. Okay? When they had that Edward Curtis show, they did not allow local Indian people to respond to that. That's a slight. You do not bring other Indians in and have your local Indians not have a response. We have a response to that because we live with the stereotypes that Curtis put on those other tribes, that he elevated those, and then colonists, other people, whoever, nons, come and they expect us to look like that. They expect us to do those things. They expect to buy artwork that represents that. And that's wrong. The PAM is replicating other collections from other museums without doing that. Now, if you go all the way down south to San Francisco, all the way down into Southern California, their artwork too is just missing. And it's not because they're not producing it, it's because people are not supporting it and they're not buying it. It's because that artwork up north is better. That's what you're telling us. So as much as I would like to make artwork about my vision, which is not actually very good, you don't want to get wrapped up into this brain, right? But it would be nice to have that opportunity. It would be nice to have not be invisible even within our own community. I mean, when I talk about the state. So anyways, I'll push my little soapbox underneath there.
No, but it's true. The loneliest person is standing in the middle of a crowd and no one speaks to them. And yet they're surrounded by a lot of people. You know, it's interesting how we do that, how we, you know, relegate certain groups of people to just oblivion. You're in the shadows and that's where you're supposed to be, and you know, it's easier for us. It's easier for us.
I mean, I do paint a buffalo, a horse riding a buffalo, riding an eagle. That's actually my daughter at age 9 said that. This is what I want to paint, you know, she was very funny at the time, like, because this is what people expect, you know.
Yeah. Giving you advice.
Yeah, I just copy all of her ideas and I'll probably be very happy.
So what is the piece of art that you would love to see? If someone came to you and said, give us authenticity, what should we be buying from you? Or what should we be watching you make? Not buying, because I know
watching
that's another bird.
Right.
That's another buzzword.
Well,
that would really teach.
I like to make things that perpetuate art. So it is like, if somebody was to come to me, you make a canoe for this community, I would feel better about myself. You make paddles for this group that has a canoe, I would feel better about myself. You make, because you're not only supporting me, you're supporting their efforts to become whole. Let's make these items here and give it to weavers so that they can build this. So it's not just one person. We gotta think like the environment, right? We gotta think like trees, right? Trees take care of other trees. People don't know that. Trees have a heartbeat. You know, there's a new study of that. That's how we should be operating it in society. When we have more than what we need, we build a bigger table. We don't build goddamn walls, okay?
That's right.
So as Indian people, that's what we do, right? Sorry.
So I told him you were coming.
Scrub that.
That's beautiful.
I love that. That it's taking it away from the objectification and possession of Native art to something that is part, that makes you part of the community, or adds to, or, you know, builds the community in a way in its efforts to reclaim its culture.
Yeah. It's just,
sorry.
No. Go ahead.
I think on top of that, like understanding that there's a breadth of Native art and genres and media that is used by Native artists. And people, like, I think especially this expectation of this museum, like Alaskan Pacific Northwestern kind of art that is inundated in, like, the Portland Art Museum, sometimes Native art doesn't look how white people would expect it to look. It doesn't look Native. One of my favorite Native artists is a drag queen in San Francisco named Landa Lakes, like the butter. And she does, I mean, her drag is in full regalia, and she does, like, she goes to two-spirit powwows, and it's full of Native queens performing. And it's amazing and beautiful and so rich, and I would love to see more people understanding and engaging with that kind of work.
Yeah, for real. Man, I used to do Native American flutes. I built Native American flutes since I was a little kid, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It's that part of community. You know, we've probably given away more flutes than we ever sold because it was about that community effort. You know, we're teaching these young kids how to play the flute. And then those select few go on to make flutes with us. And then they go on to help make flutes as well. And it was very hard for me because when flute making became a job, it wasn't fun anymore. And not only was it not fun, but then I couldn't teach anybody how to do that. Because then it was a distaste. It was no longer that people just aren't appreciating or buying. But then we had e-commerce stuff happening where it was just everywhere all of a sudden. It's all over the internet. You can buy like 4- and 5-barreled flutes and stuff. And it takes away from the healing properties of what it was meant for originally in our tribe. And then that's it. It's just cultural capital. It's something to hang on the wall. Something to remember the time you went to Saturday Market instead of remembering a people or the songs that were played there. And it's very, very frustrating to me. And it was about respecting the tree. We had to cut it down and slice it up and dry it, be there and sing the magical song, all that. You know, for real, there's a magical flute song. I kid you not.
You don't have to explain that. You're actually putting your magic into it.
You're my tree beat, bro. Right? Slide over. But, you know, well, yeah, it became a job. And then I laid it to rest. I retired. I retired in, like, 2006. And Portland Native American community was devastated. They're like, oh, my God, they're going to quit doing flute making stuff. And it's because I just could not. There wasn't any love there. You know, we'd make flutes and they wouldn't sound right. And there has to be a certain part of it. And it'll be something for my son, I think, that, you know, I'll be able to teach, you know, hoop dancing and Native American flute too. Because really, you're only supposed to teach like one person in your line. I mean, we're generational flute makers in my family. I've been doing it since the dawn of time. I can't imagine not doing it. You know, so when people ask me to make flutes now, and they say, oh, you know, we'll give you X amount. I'm appreciative of that. But then I take the money and I just give it to somebody else. Or, you know, I will just go ahead and give them the flutes anyway. Because what they're doing for community is so much greater than what I could ever do with the cash they would ever give me. It's so much better. And I remember making flutes with my dad and my grandpa and my uncle Ward. It was very, very interesting because, like, you know, after we, you know, cut trees and we get it all together and we have these flute blanks, you know, and we're out there and we're smudging, singing the magical flute song, real song. Then we would take all of these shavings, the different types, and we call the Audubon Society. And I remember dropping them off there, you know, for the eagles and the owls and all that that was there. So we're recycling and reusing this tree all the way down to it until we have, you know, like the first sweat of the year where I actually burn flutes, you know, the ones that aren't prepared. You know, we ask for that forgiveness and that thanks for that tree body for this way of life to be more watchful so we're not so wasteful. You know, in that part of community. And I wouldn't know that without some of my aunties there. I wouldn't know that without my mom. I wouldn't know that without that strong Native American backbone that we have in all the women or of the warrior men. You know, I wouldn't know any of that stuff. And it's because of, it's something that we call flute magic, is that when one person is in the garage and they're helping another person, you are now instilling in them something that they didn't know before. And because of that, the magic that happens to carry that on through their life, and they affect everybody they shake hands with, and they shake hands with, and so on and so on. So I think that in supporting Native American art, local Native American art, is that you're supporting a lot more than just the artists themselves. You get to see that artist do something fantastic, but then also you get to see all the people that are also affected by the art, and whoever they shake hands with, and whoever they shake hands with, to be able to support each other, because that's really the essence of community.
I can bring a writer's perspective to this a little bit.
Yes, please.
So I recently wrote a piece for Yes Magazine. Well, I guess that was in March, about the whole Sherman Alexie thing, Sherman Alexie Me Too thing, and I did a lot of interviews about it. I interviewed a lot of Native people in the Native literary world, and I learned a lot of things that I was not aware of before. I have to be honest, I had no idea that Sherman was doing those things. I
met him over the years. He was always very nice to me, and I just was completely did not know. And so I talked to a lot of the women who had been Native women who had been impacted by that, who had been sexually harassed and mm-hmm. such, and. And actually, Native women whose careers had been sidelined by sidelined their careers. He did do that, you know, and I think the thing for writers is that I really began thinking about Native literature, and the fact that we don't have a lot of control over it. We're not the publishers. We're not the main audience, even. I mean, most of the buyers of Native literature are not Native, you know? And the people making the decisions, the editors, the publishers, the agents are not Native either, you know? And so in this way, they were happy they had Sherman, and they were willing to stick with that for 25 years and really not do much work, you know, trying to bring more Native voices to the front. And I think that when I write, I try to be constructive, right, in my analysis, and I try to find something that will help bring our community together and help us, you know, emerge out of this stronger and better than we were before. And I often tell people that when I get other Native writers calling me for advice, and I say, punch up, you know, if you're going to write an editorial, punch up, don't punch down, you know. Mm-hmm. And definitely my target in my article was the white publishing industry, not even really Sherman. And one of the things I talked about in the thing was the issue of the power of yes, you know, the power of yes. I mean, for a writer or an artist, you know, hearing that yes makes all the difference in their careers. You know, it's being given entree and. And you know, I interviewed one Lakota writer from Standing Rock. Her name was Tiffany Midge, and her career was sidelined by Sherman. And I got a quote from her, and she just was like, well, maybe I deserve to have this happen to me. Maybe I deserve to be mocked and belittled. Maybe I wasn't cool enough or good enough, and everything. And it's like, you know, she's a really great writer, you know, and. You know, I asked her point blank, I said, are there books that you did not write because of the scorn he heaped upon you and the doors he closed in the publishing industry to you? Mm-hmm. And she's like, yes, there are. Mm-hmm. And I preparing the article, I had not really followed his career that closely, and I ended up watching a lot of his old interviews and, you know, with Bill Moyers and all those things. And he talks about how he was very deep into alcoholism, and if he hadn't gotten that letter from the publisher saying they'd publish his poetry, he would have just died like his dad did, an alcoholic, you know? And that's when I thought about, you know, the power of yes, that he got that yes in the mail that said, yes, we'll publish your book, you know? And so as artists, you know, we need to hear that yes, we need that support, and certainly, I did the math. I didn't include this in the article. I did the math about how many Native writers are published versus their percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. And if all things were fair, we'd be being published just as frequently as everyone else, right? And it turns out like 400 books more could be published a year from Native Americans that go to white writers. You know, that's the no. Those are the 400 no's, right? And all the books that you don't get to read. And the things you don't get to know, and the financial support that writers don't get to pursue their stories. Sure. And so that's just what I want to talk about. It's the power of yes.
Is there a publishing company that's being organized for Native peoples, run by Native people?
There are a few. Yeah, I think it's but it's still very much a New York City game.
Yes, yes, understood. I know in a small way here, even in Portland, because I've been doing theater and music for a long time, some of you know that, but there was a time when if I spoke out about too many things that they didn't want to hear me speak out about, they would just say, sing. Oh, Julianne, go ahead and sing. Right? Don't talk. say. It's important that I had a voice, and so I started producing my own shows, just like they did the film, just like artists are doing what they need to do. It's the empowerment. It's not easy. You have to find like-minded people who may not look like you, who believe in what you want to do, because they have the clout to open the door and hold it open for a second. They can't hold it open forever. They won't, because they don't have the tenacity to do that. That's within our culture. But they will hold the door open for a second. But you have to be equipped and then step in, you know? So education, right? That's what's happening right now within the community, right? Education, educating the young so that they can be empowered. I have one last question. And this one is a personal question for me. How do we protect the women? And I want to hear from the men and the women. How do we educate and protect the women so that they can just walk through a forest if they want to?
I'd say the first step, I think, is just listening. Listening is always the first step. That's what people have been telling me. Just listen. Take your time. Gain their perspective, you know? And it's ourselves. It's someone also had told me that to keep your male friends, family accountable for their actions.
That's right.
And it's our job to keep them accountable.
Yeah, from your perspective, from you. Right?
Exactly.
Yes.
I think staying open and staying involved, because if we have a perspective like I was talking about earlier, if you think about walking down the street, you got to think of that perspective that you often wouldn't think about from the female perspective of how you would do things. And I think that when I put that out there to people, it really changed their mind. Wow, I didn't think of that. And also, I'd say that a part of being involved, part of listening is also about what Ron's talking about, is also about speaking out. And some of us men, and all of us that are in this film, you know, have experienced domestic violence to us, and not said anything.
Right.
Yeah. And having that safety to be able to say, you know, brother, this happened to me, and then hearing their story as well, and then being there to be able to be an open ear, but then also knowing when to take action, when to be involved, and how to be involved, is really, that time is just going to come to you. But you have to be open, you have to be ready for that. You have to be willing to listen. And being able to listen is also being able to make sure that you are in a good space to be able to know what to do. And whatever you feel like doing, make sure it is the right course for what you feel. But just get involved. That's what I'll say. Just get involved. Because not another sister, not another forgotten person, not another red dress.
Right.
Not another indigenous person. There are other things out there that are stealing us away, and we don't need this. And our indigenous people don't need to lose anyone. This is not just a, and I've said it before, it's not just a Native American issue. This is an all indigenous issue. We showed this in Paris. We had Melbourne and Mexico City next to us, and some folks had no idea what's going on, and both of them said, you know, this happens in my country.
That's right.
And I'm so glad that you said this.
That's right.
I'm so glad you put this together. I know this must have been hard, and that was something for us that I felt like, you know, when we were coming up with a name for this, we put missing indigenous to mean all Native people. You're Native to that land. You're indigenous to that. And just, you know, just for the respect to everybody, but, you know, get involved.
This is, go ahead, sorry. Well, I was just going to say, you probably can address this much bigger, better than I can, but at least just on Native lands, legal jurisdictions need to change, because a huge part of the problem is that certain Native lands are just known as hunting grounds for sexual predators, because they can come onto reservation land, commit crimes, and they can't be prosecuted for it, except at the federal level, and the feds aren't interested. And so that right there would take an enormous amount of work to get done, but that's what needs to happen to change those laws.
So that's, it's happening. So I actually just published an article about the search for Olivia Lone Bear, which is another reason I've been going up to North Dakota to help search for her with her family in on the Fort Berthold Reservation, which is in the middle of the Bakken. A third of the Bakken oil is right there on the Fort Berthold Reservation, the Manan Hidatsa Rikara Reservation. And about 30% of the oil, fracked oil, comes out of the Bakken, comes from that reservation. And Olivia Lone Bear went missing in, I think, October 24th, 2017. So she's been missing for just over 6 months. And her family is still searching for her. The reservation is over 1 million acres. And I opened the article, actually, talking, I had seen the film White Wind River, right? And I opened the article saying, you know, most Native families never find a body. You know, there is no body. They don't get answers. They certainly don't get the tribal police taking bullets and storming man camps. You know, actually often with many of the families I spoke to, the Lone Bears, the Lorings, and up in the Yakima Nation, the tribal police are actually very unhelpful, you know. I actually titled my article No Crime Scene, because when the Lone Bear family tried to go and file a missing persons claim for their loved one, they were told by the tribal police because there was no crime scene, they couldn't file a missing persons report. And I talked to some folks I know at the BI police, and they said that's not a thing. They were being given the runaround. And there was very little searching going on, and they were turnaround searchers, volunteers. They turned them away, boats, everything. And it was they were very unhelpful, you know. And then there's, of course, the issue of jurisdiction. Many reservations, I don't want to get too much history, but there was the Major Crimes Act was passed back in the 19th century, which said that there were 5 major crimes that tribes could not prosecute, and that includes murder, right? And so therefore it all goes to the federal level. The FBI has to prosecute, and they declined to prosecute over 70% of the cases. And so basically it is known, and so this creates a jurisdictional gap, which means that I, as a Native woman, am less safe on my reservation than I am here, right? Because that means that the tribal police cannot prosecute. If a white man were to attack me, there's nothing they could do, because it would have to go to the FBI, right? Yeah. They don't have jurisdiction over non-federally enrolled people. If you're not enrolled in a federally recognized tribe, they don't have jurisdiction over you. And people know this. You know, in prison stuff, they know this. They know they can go and commit crimes on the reservation and murder and kill Native people. And so there was the VAWA was amended in 2015, the Violence Against Women's Act, and includes limited jurisdiction for tribes. And this was supposed to be passed in 2013, but it was held up for 2 years by Republicans who did not want to give tribes any jurisdiction over white people, over non-Indians, right? And so they finally got limited jurisdiction, which is if they actually are in a domestic violence issue and they are in some kind of meaningful relationship with the person. So it's very limited, and only a few, some tribes have, the Fort Berthold tribe is not qualified for that, to get that jurisdiction yet. You have to go through a whole process. So, and it doesn't include violence against children in the home, and they want to amend it to include that. And so protecting Native women, it would definitely involve restoring jurisdiction to the tribes. You know, tribes are sovereign nations. When you enter into their land, it's just like going to another country. You know, you have to follow their rules. And so I would definitely say that, as you pointed out, that jurisdictional issues are a big part of it, and the U.S. government is a big part of the problem because of the refusal to recognize sovereignty. See, our sovereignty is suppressed by the U.S. government, by active laws by the U.S. government, and this endangers our lives. So if you want to protect Native women, change the laws, you know, give full jurisdictional rights to our nations.
Right, right. We're back to our duty, right, as American citizens to vote, to change, to make change happen. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank the panel so much for being here and being so open and sharing so much of their story. There used to be a song that we would sing that said, I need you, you need me. We're all a part of God's body. Stand with me, agree with me. You're all a part of our family. It is His will that every need be supplied. You are important to me. I need you to survive. Have a good night. Thank you for coming. We appreciate you. Good night.